This is Audible.
Welcome. You are about to embark on a unique learning adventure from the Great Courses. Our courses are crafted to be entertaining journeys, both comprehensive and fascinating. They're designed to expand horizons, deepen understanding, and foster epiphanies in a broad array of subjects and university-level disciplines. The lecturers are university professors and subject matter experts carefully selected by the Great Courses and its customers for their intellectual distinction and exceptional abilities to teach. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalogs or visit our website at thegreatcourses.com and imagine how much you can learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the company of some of the greatest minds in the world. These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. These lectures are titled Ancient Mesopotamia, Life in the Cradle of Civilization. Your lecturer is Amanda H. Padani. Dr. Padani is a professor of history at California State Polytechnic University, Pomona. She received her Ph.D. in ancient Near Eastern history from the University of California, Los Angeles. Dr. Padani is the author of The Ancient Near East, a very short introduction, The Land of Hana, Kings, Chronology, and Scribal Tradition, and the award-winning Brotherhood of Kings, How International Relations Shaped the Ancient Near East. She has published on the Hana Kingdom, Scribal Traditions, and Ancient Legal Practices. Lecture 1. Uncovering Near Eastern Civilization.
Hello. When I'm introduced to people at social situations like dinner parties, there's always that question we all get asked. So, what do you do? I'm a historian. Oh, do you teach? Yes, I'm a professor of ancient history. Ancient history, like the Greeks and Romans? No, earlier than that. I study the ancient Near East, Mesopotamia. At this point, I usually get one of two looks. One is the glazed expression of someone trying to remember anything about Mesopotamia. The other is the quizzical expression of someone wondering why in the world I chose this particular area of study. How did you get interested in that, they ask, as though I'd expressed a passion for the study of something ridiculously esoteric, like the anatomy of olive pits. The reaction would be different if I were to say that ancient Egypt was my field of history. Everyone is fascinated by Egypt. It has a really good PR team. So many specials and documentaries on TV. Entire sections of museum bookstores. Kits to teach yourself hieroglyphs. All those mummies and pyramids and obelisks. And if I were to say that I'm an archaeologist, again, the reaction would be different. Archaeology has a swashbuckling aura. Archaeologists are fearless people who go to distant places and find mysterious buried remains from long-forgotten times. Unfortunately, Mesopotamia has no Indiana Jones, so my passion for this subject needs explanation, which underscores the need for this course. But I hope that after I've told you something about my work, you'll share my excitement for this amazing field. Mesopotamia is the ancient name for what's now Iraq. People have often heard of it because it was home to a lot of firsts. The world's first cities, the earliest writing, the first written laws, the first diplomatic relationships, along with a host of other things. That's all true. But Mesopotamia was much more than a place of firsts. Its civilization was rich and long-lasting, surviving for more than 3,000 years. In fact, Mesopotamian civilization lasted longer than the amount of time that has passed from its demise to the present day. Mesopotamian kingdoms flourished for almost two-thirds of the time that civilization has existed on Earth. Even so, those Mesopotamian kingdoms ended up being largely forgotten for thousands of years. In contrast, ancient Greek and Roman writings were kept alive by one generation after another of scribes, scholars, and students. The same is true of the Bible and the history of the Israelites. There's an unbroken tradition of classical studies and biblical studies from ancient times to now. The study of Mesopotamian history began relatively recently with the decipherment of their writing system about 170 years ago. This was accompanied by a flurry of archaeological excavations in Iraq, Iran, and Syria, work that has continued ever since. The excavations revealed cities of great sophistication that thrived in an era long before the Greeks, Romans, and Israelites. And the excavations uncovered ancient documents by the thousands. More than 250,000 documents have been found, many of them still unpublished. Many haven't even been read yet. So being a Mesopotamian historian is like being an explorer of uncharted waters. We make new discoveries all the time. In most fields of history, everyone knows the basic framework, the timeline and names and events that lie along it. Mesopotamia is different. Not only do unexpected kings, queens, and other prominent figures show up frequently, but when clay tablets are newly translated, entire kingdoms can emerge. There aren't many of us who specialize in ancient Mesopotamia, so there's no shortage of research projects. It's incredibly exciting to uncover new details of ancient civilizations, details that literally nobody has known about for thousands of years. Now, to answer that dinner party question, how did I get interested in this field? From about the age of 8, I wanted to be an archaeologist. But in graduate school, I decided I was going to be a historian, for reasons I'll explain in a moment. I grew up in a village south of London. My backyard was full of all sorts of interesting things. There were bowls of clay tobacco pipes and sharp fragments of willow pattern china from the 19th century. I collected these and kept searching for more. My parents wanted to nurture my interest, so they found an archaeology program for kids at the local library. The group met once a week, and I was completely hooked. This was what I wanted to do. Later, as an undergraduate at UCLA in Southern California, a class on ancient Near Eastern archaeology captivated my interest, and I ended up taking the whole sequence of classes. I was also playing bass in a rock band. My days were filled with attending class and completing my assignments, and my evenings were taken up by the band. A couple of years later, I was back in England, doing a master's degree at the Institute of Archaeology in London. Well, my old band added a couple of new members and changed their name to the Bangles. They spent the late 1980s recording and performing around the world. But I'm happy I chose an academic career. I'd started taking classes in the ancient Mesopotamian language of Akkadian, which was written in a script known as cuneiform. Cuneiform signs are made up of straight lines with wedge-shaped heads. Cuneiform isn't an alphabet. Each sign could represent a whole word or a syllable, or even something called a determinative. Determinatives help the reader know what category a word belonged to. So you would find a determinative for city names, for the names of men and of women, and for things made of wood and so on. Each sign has more than one possible value, and each syllable can be represented by several different signs. So hundreds of cuneiform signs were used. Learning to read cuneiform and to understand Akkadian was thrilling. Reading the ancient texts was like being privy to a hidden world. So when I returned to the U.S. once more, I decided to do my PhD at UCLA in history rather than archaeology. Still, the two are closely tied together in the study of ancient Mesopotamia and Syria. Every cuneiform text that we read and study was dug out of the ground at some point. And knowing the exact context where it was found can add a whole additional level of understanding of its content. During graduate school, I got the opportunity to join an excavation. This was at the site of Tell Ashara in eastern Syria. What is now a small village was once a major city. It's on top of an occupation mound called a tell in Arabic that's made up of the remains of all the settlements built on that spot over centuries. Anywhere you dig on a tell, you can't help but discover objects from the past. Of course, contemporary villagers had no interest in seeing their houses and yards dug up by archaeologists, so the excavations were mostly at the edge of the tell and in a city park. What was it like to work on a dig? It was unlike anything I'd done before. The team of graduate students and archaeologists I worked with lived in rented rooms in the village of Ashara. Our house was built in the same way that had been used there for thousands of years. It was made of mud brick, with the rooms arranged around an unpaved courtyard. There was no plumbing. And though electricity recently had been introduced in the village, and our rooms had electric lights, air conditioning wasn't one of the conveniences. Fortunately, though, it got cool at night, and the mud brick provided insulation against the sun. I often sat on the flat roof of our house in the evenings, and I watched the sunset over the nearby fields and the river. It was beautiful. We'd wake up each morning, before the sun rose, to excavate during the coolest hours of the day. The whole team ate breakfast together, around a big table. Then we headed up to the excavation, where the workmen met us. I was in charge of a 10 by 10 meter square. That's a little more than 30 feet by 30 feet. I worked with two villagers who did most of the digging and who moved the mud out of the square. They were experienced excavators who could find the edge of a mud brick wall almost by intuition. The distinction between ancient mud brick and the ancient mud that surrounded it was a lot less obvious than I'd imagined. I dug as well, of course, and it was my job to record everything we found and to carefully excavate anything small or delicate. As spring turned to summer, the village grew hotter. On a couple of days, it reached 117 degrees in the shade. At that point, we'd retreat to the dig house and work on our documentation. Later, the team gathered again at dinner time to eat and to discuss the day's finds. On Fridays, when no one worked, we'd take bus trips to other archaeological sites. These visits included the incredible Roman cities of Palmyra and Dura Europus, and the older sites of Mari and Tel Brak. Wherever we stopped, the local people would bring out blankets, and we'd sit and talk with them. Our hosts often gave us apricots from their trees, and they'd offer us glasses of sweet tea. The part of the site where I worked held the foundations of an administrative building from the 18th century BCE. We uncovered two burials, along with a well, lined with large baked clay cylinders. One burial interred the remains of a tiny baby who'd been placed in a jar in the courtyard. It was really moving to lift the broken pottery and see the tiny skull inside. And we found some cuneiform tablets. These consisted of a letter and some administrative texts. I realized as I excavated these ancient documents that until now, no one else had read them or even touched them from the moment they'd been abandoned about 3,800 years ago. The records would help us know who'd worked in this building and what they cared about. With only a little bit of imagination, those same documents could bring ancient Terka to life and repopulate our surroundings with their ancient inhabitants. Since that time, much of my research has centered on the findings from the city of Terka and the kingdom that it dominated, a kingdom called Hana, which thrived during the mid-second millennium BCE. Only a handful of scholars are devoted to the study of Hana, though it lasted for several centuries. Unfortunately, to date, fewer than 100 cuneiform tablets have been identified as coming from there. No doubt we'll know a great deal more someday in the future when more tablets have been excavated. They're certainly there in the ground somewhere. Now, we're lucky that the Mesopotamians wrote on clay. That's because paper, papyrus, and parchment all disintegrate over time, Papyrus documents typically survive only in desert areas. Otherwise, there's almost nothing left after a few hundred years if they're buried in the ground. As a result, there are giant gaps in our knowledge of ancient civilizations that used organic substances to document their lives. Although many documents do survive from ancient Egypt, Greece, Rome, and Israel, these are the ones that were considered so important that they were copied over and over again. Only a few managed to survive in the ground. So what's usually missing are records of daily life, the letters, administrative lists, contracts, court records, and so on, that would give us a deeper understanding of their cultures and of people who weren't the movers and shakers. Now, these are exactly the kinds of documents that we do have from Mesopotamia, and we have them in huge numbers. Some ancient clay tablets were baked on purpose to preserve them. Others were baked by accident when the buildings burned down. Baked tablets are usually well preserved. They're like bricks. Other tablets were left out in the sun to harden. They might still survive in the ground, but often they fall apart easily, and they need to be pieced together and conserved. For the most part, these clay tablets were not intended to be preserved or to be read hundreds or thousands of years in the future. They're not like stone inscriptions or great works of philosophy or literature that were copied and kept in libraries. Most tablets were quite practical. They were documents written for a particular purpose and then archived or discarded. They include lists of people receiving rations, lists of animals sent as offerings to temples, contracts recording the hiring of workmen, descriptions of court cases, multiplication tables, personal letters, records of loans, things like that. And literacy wasn't widespread. Scribes, the few men and a tiny number of women who were educated, fulfilled particular responsibilities. They don't seem to have written for introspective reasons. There aren't any Mesopotamian diaries, and even their letters tend to be very practical. So the insights we get into their lives are rarely personal, but there's a great deal that can be learned from the quotidian documents that survive. I often think about the people whose names populate the documents. I imagine that they'd be astounded to know that they've achieved a sort of immortality because of the clay tablets they left behind. We know their names and the names of their relatives and neighbors and the locations of their houses and fields. These were normal men and women who'd lived as farmers, priests, barbers, innkeepers, and still we analyze every detail of their lives. What social class did they belong to? Who were the members of their close social networks? How long were their generations? I recently added a new name to a Mesopotamian family tree that I'd worked on before. In doing so, I realized that two men who obviously were friends had given their sons the same name. Now, this is a minor curiosity. I couldn't help wondering who chose the name first, and if the friend copied him when naming his son. Billions of people have lived on the planet since 1750 BCE. Even so, I feel a particular tie to the families who lived in Turka all those years ago. I've stood in their courtyards and streets. The records we find in their houses and in their neighbors' houses have brought them back to our attention centuries after they'd been completely forgotten. Fortunately, we can read these ancient words relatively easily today. This is thanks to the efforts of a number of 19th century scholars who deciphered cuneiform almost 2,000 years after it was last used. Of course, it's hard to decipher a script or language without a bilingual text that includes the same document in a known language along with an unknown one. For Egyptian hieroglyphs, the key was the Rosetta Stone. This is a stone inscription from Egypt, bearing the decree of a Ptolemaic king. It includes the same text in Greek and in two forms of Egyptian, so that all literate Egyptians could read it. The Greek version provided the key to understanding the hieroglyphic inscription. For cuneiform, one document that served this same purpose was the Behistun inscription, Unlike the Rosetta Stone, it's never been located in a museum. It's a giant carving on the side of an inaccessible mountain in Iran. The story is an interesting one. In 1836 and 1837, an intrepid scholar and adventurer named Henry Rawlinson climbed the mountain face several times. He made copies of part of the inscription. He even made some papier-mâché molds of some sections. He realized that there were three separate versions of the text, all in cuneiform. And he guessed, rightly, as it turned out, that they might be in three different languages. By 1838, Rawlinson and an Irishman named Edward Hinks had deciphered the easiest of the three languages with the help of an international group of scholars. Hinks had worked on cuneiform previously, and Rawlinson used some of his insights. This part of the Behistun inscription turned out to be an ancient version of the Persian language. It used an alphabetic cuneiform script with 43 characters. Old Persian was enough like Middle and Modern Persian to be understandable, and the text proved to be a royal inscription by the Persian king Darius I, who lived in the 5th century BCE. The second version of the inscription had 131 different characters and was in an ancient language called Elamite. It was deciphered later by a different group of scholars. The last version of Darius's Behistun inscription turned out to be in Akkadian, the language that was spoken and written in Mesopotamia for centuries. It was much harder to decipher. Rawlinson went back to Behistun in 1847, 10 years after he'd begun the project, to work on this third version of the text. However, Edward Hinks had already completed a lot of the decipherment using different trilingual inscriptions, also from Iran. So it was known that this form of cuneiform represented a Semitic language. By now, Hinks had sent a number of letters to scholarly societies in which he'd noted several important details about the script, and he was right about all of them. He'd even figured out values for many of the signs. But Henry Rawlinson is almost always credited with having deciphered Akkadian cuneiform. So who really managed this feat? While both men worked hard during the late 1840s and 1850s, Hinks made the best progress. And we now know that he had the most accurate values for the signs. Rawlinson grew annoyed with his colleague and even mocked his conclusions. He suggested that Hinks had a few fortunate hits, but was mostly wrong. To start with, Rawlinson thought the cuneiform writing system had grown out of the Egyptian system, and he thought it was mostly alphabetic. He was mistaken. Hinks recognized that every cuneiform sign could be read as a complete syllable. Each one could be read as a consonant plus a vowel, or a vowel plus a consonant, or a combination of consonants and vowels. But not one of them represented a consonant all by itself. He was right about all of this. By 1857, Rawlinson had come around to agreeing with Hinks's conclusions. They and two other scholars identified the values of hundreds of cuneiform signs, and they mastered most of the grammar of the Akkadian language as well. In the same year, the Royal Asiatic Society in London came up with a test to see if the decipherment was successful. They gave a newly discovered cuneiform inscription to all four men and had them translate it, independently of one another. Their translations turned out to be pretty much the same. The code had been cracked. Edward Hinks died in 1866, and Rawlinson ended up getting most of the credit. But more and more scholars now recognize that Hinks was the real genius who figured out the major keys to the decipherment of Akkadian. Students often ask me how we know what ancient Akkadian sounded like. We can't be sure of every detail, but Akkadian is enough like later Semitic languages for us to be pretty confident that we know how it sounded. We're also lucky that the script regularly reflects not just the consonants, but also the vowels. In this, it's different from Egyptian hieroglyphs and from later alphabetic scripts, like Phoenician and early Hebrew. Once Akkadian was deciphered, it was possible to decode some of the other ancient languages that were written in cuneiform. One of the most important of these was Sumerian. This was the language of ancient Sumer, the southern part of Mesopotamia, and it was probably the language of the ancient inventors of the writing system. Sumerian was used in literature and religion long after it had ceased to be a spoken language. So ancient scribes had long lists of Sumerian words and their Akkadian equivalents. These lists helped with the modern decipherment. Once cuneiform was understood, a great deal of work was done in translating Mesopotamian documents. This provided a lot of the groundwork for those of us who have come after those early scholars. They introduced us to great kings like Sargon of Akkad and Hammurabi of Babylon. They produced editions of law codes and royal inscriptions. They shone a light on a world that had not been known before. And they inspired generations of archaeologists to find and excavate the ancient occupation mounds where the cities and towns of these ancient peoples lay buried. Despite the longevity of their civilization over thousands of years, Mesopotamians faced constant threats. These could take the form of warfare and natural disasters, disease, infections, crop damage, famine, and deaths of loved ones. The Mesopotamians could control none of these. So they treasured the order they could maintain. They had close communities, and they valued and supported their friends and families. They developed a judicial system. They expected contracts and treaties to be upheld and obligations to be met. And they emphasized kindness and civility in their interactions. It always strikes me that they, or most of them at least, were people I would like to have known. So let's get to know them. In this course, we'll explore the Mesopotamian world from the era of the first settlements more than 12,000 years ago to the earliest cities in the 4th millennium BC, and we'll end up in the 6th century BCE when Mesopotamia was conquered by the Persian Empire during the reign of Cyrus the Great. And the people there were no longer ruled by a government within their own land. We'll look at religion, which pervaded everyone's understanding of the universe, and at kingship, society, agriculture, trade, justice, literature, art, warfare, daily life, and more. And we'll encounter some extraordinary people. Kings like Sargon, who created the world's first empire, and Ornama, who developed the first written laws, and Tushratta, who maintained an affectionate correspondence with the pharaohs of Egypt. Others were religious leaders, like Enheduanna, a priestess who survived an attempt to expel her and wrote hymns about her experiences. We'll meet princesses like Kiram of Mari, who was so miserable in her marriage that she threatened to jump off the roof of her husband's palace, and authors like Sinleke Unini, who wrote the Epic of Gilgamesh. Some of the people who illuminate this era would never have guessed that they'd be remembered so many thousands of years later. These include Amat Shamash, a woman who bequeathed her house to her daughter, only to have her brothers contest it in court after her death. You might be surprised that a written will, spoken testimony, and justice prevailed on behalf of the younger woman in the face of her more powerful uncles. All of these people, and millions of others like them, lived and loved, worried and celebrated during the long centuries of Mesopotamia's power. They cared about the events of their day with the same passion that we have for events in our lives. And they had no idea how things would turn out. It's always tempting to see history as somehow inevitable, that the way things did happen was the only way they could have happened. We reflexively tend to think of these people as simply going along with the script. But that's not true. Each person was an actor in this vast panorama of history, responding to the events of their time. But they had no lines to read. They were making it up as they went along. The documents and objects and buildings that survive give us a window into their lives. We can read their words, stand in their houses, admire their sculptures, and try our best to reconstruct their world and to understand them.
Lecture 2, Natufian Villagers and Early Settlements.
Remember life before cell phones, we would leave home every day with no easy way to contact the people we planned to meet up with, or the people we depended on to pick us up from school or work. There was no way for someone to call us if we were away from home, to say that traffic was bad or they were running late, or to be reminded of what to buy at the supermarket. And through all those years, we were fine. We didn't wring our hands and wish someone would hurry up already and invent cell phones. We didn't know the future would be so much easier. Later, we didn't wish that smartphones would show up. And it wasn't long before we were able to watch cat videos while standing in line for coffee. The technology that we had was all we thought we needed. When something new came along to change everything, it was a surprise. I mention this because we tend to look back at history and note all the things that were missing in any given era. What did they do without clocks? No printing press, no wheel, no plow, no plumbing. But of course, we have perfect hindsight and can see what an advantage it was to have those things once they were invented. The people who lived without them didn't know what they were missing. We also tend to assume that once a new technology appeared, it must have been adopted with relish. But was that true? It's often been observed that the spread of any technology tends to be slow. People don't leap to adopt the invention. First, they wonder, what is it? Why might it be useful? How much does it cost? These aren't obvious at the time. You probably can think of examples like this in your own lifetime. I remember reading a magazine article about the internet in the early 90s and being completely mystified. How could one visit sites on a computer? What would be the point of doing so? We seemed to be getting along just fine without this new internet thing. Little did we know. All this brings us to the question of how and why agriculture originated and spread. The when and where are relatively uncontroversial. Early agriculture originated about 10,500 years ago in the Near East, around northwestern Syria and southern Turkey. But how and why? Those are thorny questions. Looking backwards from the present, we can see the enormous value of the domestication of plants and animals. And it's tempting to imagine that through all the thousands of years that humans were hunting animals and gathering plants, they were just longing for someone to get around to inventing farming, an invention that would allow them to stay in one place all year round and start accumulating possessions. Early theories often credited some ancient genius with noticing that plants grew from seeds in waste piles, and then planting seeds himself and finding that they grew. Voila, agriculture. According to this view, the self-evident advantage of farming would have resulted in mass abandonment of hunting and gathering and a quick shift to living in villages and storing surpluses. I'm exaggerating a little, but there was a sense that agriculture was an example of progress. There was also a sense that hunters and gatherers were, without doubt, at a disadvantage and therefore would have been keen to become farmers. The problem is that this is based on the same hindsight that makes us wonder what people did without clocks or phones. They did fine. Modern groups of hunters and gatherers are in no hurry to start to farm, and the same was probably true in the Neolithic period. People didn't feel themselves to be lacking in some way, subject to a void that could only be filled by farming and herding. So what happened? Can the origin of agriculture even be called an invention? Or was it a process that carried people along? What can archaeology tell us? We now know that early settlements were clearly built before the domestication of plants and animals. That's not what scholars originally thought. People didn't settle because farming allowed them to. They settled first, and then later, maybe 3,000 years later, they started to farm. Furthermore, the men and women who first started building settlements weren't the cavemen of cartoons. They were fully modern humans. If you could have frozen an embryo of an early settler for 12,000 years, he or she would grow up completely unremarkable in the modern world. No doubt texting on a smartphone, struggling to get good grades in college, and going out with friends after work. The first settlers were anatomically and intellectually modern, and they had languages that were probably just as sophisticated and expressive as modern languages are. People tend to think that language was invented when writing was, but writing came thousands and thousands of years after people had begun to talk. So the early settlers could communicate easily with one another about their lives and concerns. They just didn't have our technology. In the same way, the early settlers had already been gathering grains for millennia, and of course they must have known that plants grew from seeds. Hunting and gathering simply worked well, so they didn't need to plant their seeds to make their own food. What is a surprise is that modern hunters and gatherers have a lot more leisure time than the farmers who use the simple technologies available to them. For example, hunters and gatherers, known as the Kalahari Bushmen, who today live in a vast expanse in southern Africa, spent only about 12 to 19 hours a week collecting their food, according to one well-documented study, whereas neighboring farmers worked for at least 14 more hours a week to feed themselves. Farming is tough. Crops can fail. There are pests and diseases to worry about. One has to sow seeds, weed the fields, tend the crops, possibly water the crops if rainfall is scarce, and then harvest them. And once the harvest is in, how do you protect your food from yet more pests or mold or damp? Hunting and gathering, in comparison, is all about harvesting, leaving nature to take care of the rest. The 20th century Kalahari hunters and gatherers ate about 75 different wild plants, so they had a wide selection to draw from. And they wouldn't starve if one or even several plants suffered from a pest or was unavailable. Skeletal evidence also shows that early farmers were shorter and sicker than hunters and gatherers who came before them. Hunters and gatherers in pre-Neolithic Greece and Turkey were similar in height to modern men and women, an average of 5'9" for the men and 5'3" for the women. Once they started to farm, though, they got a lot shorter. By 3000 BCE, the men in the same region averaged 5'3" and the women 5'. This could be because farmers' diets were more restricted than the diets of hunters and gatherers, and farmers ate a lot more bread and a lot less meat than hunters did. Early farmers also had much worse teeth. Since wheat and barley need to be ground into flour to become edible, the grit from the grindstones got in their food, and it wore down their teeth. Women, who spent hours and hours every day kneeling to grind the grain, wound up with toe bones permanently fused into a crouching position. Given all these disadvantages, who would choose to farm? Some of the most popular theories suggest that humans were forced into farming, that it wasn't a choice at all. The earliest hunting and gathering settlements were located near abundant natural resources. Ideally, these included a spring or river that provided drinking water and attracted animals, as well as a source of flint for stone tools and a naturally occurring meadow full of barley or wheat. This is known as a stand of barley or wheat. Once a year, when the wild grain was ripe, it would have been harvested. In a famous experiment, a 20th century American archaeologist named Jack Harlan made a Neolithic-style sickle and harvested grain from a stand of wild einkorn wheat in Turkey. He was able to collect about 1 kilogram of clean grain, that is, about 2.2 pounds, every hour. Given the amount of wild grain that was growing in the region during the Neolithic period, Harlan estimated that a family of four could have harvested a metric ton of wheat over the course of 3 weeks. And since grain doesn't rot the way that fruits and vegetables do, this could have fed the family for a whole year. The problem was that huge amounts of grain couldn't be carried around. It needed to be stored somewhere. And once the grain was stored, there must have been a strong motivation to stay near it. This might be the original logic behind settling in one place. If that place provided food year-round, there was no need to keep following herds or to travel from place to place. A permanent shelter could be constructed, and heavy objects, such as grinding stones for processing the grain, could be kept there. The population probably grew as a result. Women could have their babies closer together because they didn't have to carry their infants around. These early settlers weren't farming, but they were starting to live with some of the disadvantages of farming that I mentioned a moment ago. They had started to depend on fewer plants for most of their calories, especially grains, so their diets were more limited and their teeth began to suffer. They had to devote time and attention to protecting the grain that they'd harvested, even though it was wild. And if a disease or drought affected their wild stand of grain and their harvest was smaller than usual, they faced a bigger problem than before. More than 14,000 years ago, in a region that includes parts of modern Israel, Lebanon, and Jordan, people belonging to what we call the Natufian culture lived just this way, living in built shelters and making the best use of the resources in their region. The area where the Natufians settled got plenty of rainfall and was where you'd find the wild ancestors of modern wheat, barley, rye, peas, lentils, sheep, goats, pigs, and cattle. In some ways, they were really lucky. They had more than just the makings of a healthy diet, they also had access to a group of species that they would end up being able to manipulate. Not many animals are particularly suited to domestication. For example, zebra don't like to be ridden, and gazelles don't follow one another in herds. So in some parts of the world, no amount of human intervention would have succeeded at domestication. The animals would have stayed just as uncontrollable as before. But in the eastern Mediterranean area, known as the Levant, domestication wasn't a problem. Wild sheep, goats, pigs, and cattle were particularly domesticable. That lay far in the future, however. We're looking at the world in about 12,500 BCE. Excavations from Natufian sites show us that these people created houses by digging circular pits and building walls of stone or wood and roofing them with reeds or hides. Smaller pits dug near the houses were lined with limestone, and they allowed the early settlers to store food, such as wild wheat and barley, for long periods of time. As many as 100 people lived near one another in villages made up of these round houses. Besides benefiting from the wild grains that grew in the area, villagers also hunted birds and gazelle. Vast amounts of gazelle bones have been found at some of the Natufian sites. There seems to have been plenty to eat. In order to hunt and to harvest wild plants, the people developed complex and beautiful stone tools. This was long before anyone thought up the technology necessary to make metal tools. The Natufians hadn't even invented pottery yet. They had fire, they cooked over it, and they used it for protection and for warmth. But its potential was still relatively unharnessed. So all man-made objects had to be shaped by hand, and this was an exacting and time-consuming process, one that none of us today could master without years of training. The stone workers made tiny flint blades 1 to 3 centimeters long with perfectly straight edges for slicing or fine serrations for cutting. These are known as microliths, and they would have been fitted into bone hafts or handles to make sickles, arrows, and knives. Each shape of blade had a specific purpose. A stone cutter holding a nodule of flint would have looked at it with an expert eye, seeing exactly where he would be able to coax a particular shape of blade out of its core by hitting it at just the right angle. Other types of stone were ground into larger shapes, such as mortars, pestles, and bowls of various kinds. The Natufian people also made bone tools, such as hooks for fishing. Fish was important to their diet as well. And they made needles for weaving. The baskets, mats, and fabrics they wove have long since disintegrated, as all organic materials do in a humid environment. But it's likely that women and men developed advanced skills in these areas. Some of us might think of ourselves as much more sophisticated than the Tufian villagers, but how many of us could weave a basket? Beads were popular too, especially beads made from seashells, and these were strung into necklaces, bracelets, and headdresses. All of this was possible without farming, because the climate was kind and natural resources were abundant. The people might even have had some sort of belief in a life after death. We can guess this because they buried their loved ones in cemeteries near their settlements, accompanied by flowers and sometimes dogs. Wolves were domesticated to become dogs right around this time. One dramatic Natufian burial, in a pit inside a cave in Israel, included the body of a 45-year-old woman who was buried with all sorts of surprising things. 50 tortoise shells, the tail of a wild cow, the pelvis of a leopard, the wing bone of an eagle, the forearm of a wild boar, a stone bowl, and a severed human foot, a foot much larger than her own. A ring of stones surrounded her grave and separated it from 27 others. The excavator concluded she was probably a shaman, someone who practiced healing and was viewed as holy in some way. Shamans probably were effective in their practice. What we now think of as the placebo effect would have worked well then too. People who believe they will get well often do. Their bodies rally to fight off infection. The shamans might also have found cures for pain or illness among the many plants available to them. All in all, life in a Natufian village probably seemed pretty good, at least for the first couple of thousand years. Food and water were plentiful, and men and women developed sophisticated skills in making tools, buildings, clothes, and baskets. They had children who grew up and had children of their own. They could defend themselves against wild animals and protect themselves from the elements. They probably told stories in the evenings, and being human, they sang songs. This must have seemed to be the way that life had always been and always would continue to be. So why did these people, sometimes in the very same villages where they had lived as hunters and gatherers, begin to farm? The fact that they did so is clear. A few thousand years later, the distinctly transformed shapes of domesticated grains, pulses, like lentils and peas, and animals show that these species had become dependent on humans for their existence. Farmers gradually chose and bred plants with bigger seeds, sheep with longer wool, and so on. Some scholars think this was an unconscious process. They call it unconscious selection. They believe that farmers didn't set out to plant larger grains that would produce more food, but instead various attributes of the grains and animals were selected for by natural processes that resulted from harvesting wild foods and taking care of young animals. Other scholars point out just how much modern hunters and gatherers know about their foods, including, for example, how to make poisonous plants edible through cooking and other processing. They think that the same could have been true in ancient times. In that case, domestication could have been quite conscious. These were smart men and women who observed new mutations of plants that occurred naturally and took advantage of them. Unfortunately, for those of us asking these questions today, the physical changes that mark plants and animals as domesticated took place a long time after domestication started. So it's not possible to mark an exact date when the process began. One popular theory as to why people started to farm is that they were spurred to do so by a changing climate. Around 11,000 years ago, the weather in the Near East got colder and drier than it had been. The plants and animals that had reliably appeared in the past, simply needing to be gathered up or hunted, became scarcer. Some communities gave up and moved. Others clung on, perhaps supplementing their diets by beginning to plant the foods that they depended on, or by keeping young animals that would grow and be useful to them. Some of the animals that were native to this area had temperaments that lent themselves to being herded. Sheep, goats, and cattle, for example. The process was extremely gradual, according to this theory. Although the domestication of plants and animals is often referred to as the agricultural revolution, it happened so slowly that it was probably invisible to the people living through it. Another theory is that settlements themselves caused the problem that ended up being solved, to some extent anyway, by domestication. The villagers had always focused their attention on the immediate area, which created environmental stress. Intense foraging and hunting destabilized the natural environment. In this case, a small trigger could suddenly limit resources dramatically. This could be a sudden increase in plant pests, for example, or a change in the movement patterns of gazelle, or a swarm of locusts. Farming and herding would have helped protect the villagers against these disasters. Or perhaps, according to yet another theory, the Natufian villagers were so successful that they grew too numerous for their local environments. The growing population couldn't be supported by continuing to hunt and gather in the immediate vicinity. So they might have started farming right where they lived in order to increase the food supply. By the way, an earlier generation of scholars hypothesized that a population increase forced people out of the central zone where the plants and animals were present. They proposed that these migrant populations then moved into marginal zones and brought the plants and animals with them, farming and herding in a region where it was not possible to hunt and gather. It's a nice theory, and it was popular when I was in grad school. But archaeologists have proved it wrong. Farming doesn't seem to have originated in these marginal zones at all. Instead, it began right around where the earlier villages first settled. A combination of theories is also possible. Perhaps climate change added to the stress on a population that had grown too large for the resources available and had already been subject to destabilization because of the overutilization of the natural resources. A very recent theory about domestication, put forward by the Israeli archaeologist Avi Gofer and the agronomist Shahal Abo, rejects the idea that the transition from hunting and gathering to farming was slow. They think it was well planned and happened surprisingly fast, in one place. Their theory holds that proto-farmers were conscious that they had selected particular seeds to plant, the very seeds that were most likely to sprout. These same proto-farmers focused on six species at the same time: barley, two types of wheat, flax, lentils, and chickpeas. In this view, they were wise planners, men and women who knew they needed the plants to be more productive than was true in the wild, and who bred them precisely for this purpose. Aside from this theory, however, it has been unpopular for quite a while to talk about the invention of farming and herding. The emphasis has been on a long process, with incremental steps along the way, that ultimately resulted in a totally different lifestyle. Most scholars believe that people didn't choose to be farmers. Who would choose that, given the disadvantages? Instead, over thousands of years, they came to depend more on the foods that they nurtured themselves and less on the foods that they gathered in the wild. No one would have any recollection of what it was like to be a pure hunter-gatherer by the time they were totally dependent on farming. And even then, they still hunted and gathered. In a way, we still do. If you go fishing, or if you gather and eat blackberries in late summer from wild bushes, or if you search for mushrooms in the forest, you're keeping a little bit of that hunting and gathering heritage alive. For now, it's impossible to know which of the many theories about the origins of the domestication of plants and animals is correct. Scholars disagree. One remarkable piece of recent evidence, though, has shaken up our image of the hunters and gatherers in the Near East. It turns out they were not only intelligent, but also organized and passionate about their beliefs in a way that was completely hidden before. The discovery is at a site called Göbekli Tepe in southeast Turkey. About 12,000 years ago, long before farming, when humans were just beginning to settle in hunting and gathering communities, a group of people erected a monument at Göbekli Tepe to their gods, It consisted of huge circles of standing stones. One of the circles is 65 feet across, and the largest of the stones weighs 16 tons. These stones are T-shaped and engraved with images of predatory and poisonous animals. The engravings are not of the prey the people of this time hunted. There are no images of gazelle or sheep or goats. Instead, they carved lions, scorpions, vultures, snakes, and foxes. There doesn't seem to have been a settlement nearby, but according to the excavators, hundreds of people must have been involved in the construction. They had to quarry the stones, drag them into position, and stand them upright. Then they engraved the images and built the walls. This took organization. Someone was in charge. The project must also have required food and water for the workers, and perhaps shelter. Klaus Schmidt, a German archaeologist who directed the excavation, proposed yet another reason for the development of agriculture. He theorized that perhaps in order to feed the workmen on this project, it was not enough to hunt and gather. They needed a more reliable source of large amounts of food. Perhaps they grew it themselves. We also have to wonder, why was this monument built? Were these the images of the gods whom the hunters and gatherers feared? Were they attempting to control natural dangers by erecting images of them? Did they bury the dead nearby? It's a mystery. Nobody invented writing for another 7,000 years after Göbekli Tepe was built, so the people of this era had no way to tell us. People certainly must have visited the site after it was built, perhaps traveling from hundreds of miles away. There's archaeological evidence of feasts taking place, huge stone bowls that would have held 40 gallons of liquid, beer maybe, and giant piles of animal bones. Visitors must have met others, shared ideas, and perhaps worshipped together. It seems that religious beliefs were already a powerful force on human behavior, even before pottery, before farming, before almost anything we define as civilization. To sum up, farming and herding completely changed the course of human history, but they didn't necessarily present an obvious advantage to the first farmers. Farming also developed independently in China, the New World, Africa, and other regions. And in each case, it was probably a lengthy process, all but invisible to each subsequent generation. People probably thought they were doing things just the same way they always had. But after 3,000 years, a very slow change. Once agriculture dominated the economy, things began to change more quickly.
Lecture 3, Neolithic Farming, Trade, and Pottery.
The Neolithic, or New Stone Age, which lasted from about 9,000 to 5,000 BCE, got its name partly from the sophistication of the stone tools that people were using. Humans had begun to plant seeds and herd animals, and they were becoming farmers. Dependence on agriculture and herded animals had developed even earlier, throughout the pre-Neolithic period, and now there was really no turning back. People still fished, hunted for birds, and gathered some plants, but the bulk of their diet came from farming. The evidence for this comes from seeds and bones found at archaeological sites. Domestication changed the species slightly. Shapes of seeds and of horn cores tell us that the plants and animals were controlled by humans. They weren't wild anymore. Farming became common throughout northern Mesopotamia and the Levant, where enough rain fell. This was still before the invention of pottery, in an era known as the pre-pottery Neolithic. One remarkable discovery from the period comes from the site of Jericho. This Neolithic community of about 300 people was built in the desert next to a gushing spring, which made life possible there. The inhabitants were able to devise ways to water their crops, as well as to use the water for drinking and washing. They even built a stone wall around their town that was 9 feet thick and 12 feet high. The Neolithic villagers also built a large stone tower about 28 feet high and 21 feet across the top, with a staircase inside. There is nothing like it anywhere else from this period, and it has mystified archaeologists and historians.